Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Last week, we predicted our winners for the BBWAA Awards, and now we'll talk a little bit about the actual choices. As expected, Aaron Judge and Cody Bellinger won AL and NL Rookie of the Year, both unanimously. Torey Lovullo of the D-backs and Paul Molitor of the Twins were named Manager of the Year. The Cy Young winners were a couple of guys who'd won before, Corey Kluber and Max Scherzer. And finally, MVPs were Jose Altuve and Giancarlo Stanton. Were there any surprises?
Don't think there were surprises in terms of the actual winners. I think the one thing that really surprised people was just how close the NL MVP race ended up being. It was a difference of 2 points between Giancarlo and Joey Votto, and that's virtually a tie. I mean, you know, I know that's not how it works, and, you know, it's every point matters, but nonetheless, you know, if the voting goes slightly differently, if someone, you know, puts one of them a spot higher, you know, the results are completely different, or, you know, maybe you do end up with an actual tie. But, yeah, that was really kind of surprising to me.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think of the list, like, the only one that is slightly surprising is Stanton, just because the trend has been generally, I mean, aside from Mike Trout, to give it to a player whose team has been a contending team during the season. And that wasn't the case with Marlins, but I mean, obviously you can't knock him winning it in any way.
Yeah, I'm not at all surprised with the Rookie of the Year, Manager of the Year, and Cy Young winners, but the MVP vote for National League just seemed a lot closer than anyone expected. And I think the one thing that really surprised me is that someone voted first place for Chris Bryant. I think when the ballots were revealed, that was the most surprising thing, is how many people placed, like, Stanton in second or sixth even. And yeah, I think it was just the placement of voting. I'm still baffled as to why Chris Bryant got a first place vote, honestly.
Don't tell Cubs fans that.
Like, he had a good year, but it's nowhere on the level of Stanton and Votto. And yeah, I agree, you know, with the whole trend of how voting has been. You know, I wasn't sure if Votto was going to be the runaway winner because, you know, dingers are great and all, but Votto had the other stats to back everything up. That being said, you know, because of this trend in voting, it makes sense that, you know, Stanton only won by 2 points. But I think it's probably going to be indicative of a lot of people maybe being aware of what's going on with the baseball and it possibly being juiced. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's what caused a lot of people to vote for Votto over Stanton, honestly.
Speaking of things benefiting offensive players that maybe aren't exactly fair, I saw a lot of backlash, mainly from Rockies fans, about a couple of their guys not faring better in the race. I saw a lot of people arguing that Nolan Arenado deserved to be MVP. I also saw people arguing for Charlie Blackmon. Do we think that there's validity to these arguments? Do we think that it's all Coors Field and these people need to get over it?
I think there's the Coors Field effect obviously exists, but I think it's also been, like, slightly over-exaggerated by a lot of people, just because it plays well into the narrative element of baseball. And I think that those guys obviously had great seasons, and they deserve to be at least in talks for the MVP award, but I don't think that you can really look at it objectively and say they had stronger cases than what ended up happening.
Yeah, and as, you know, obviously as someone who's followed the Rockies pretty closely recently, Arenado is amazing defensively, but didn't have a great offensive year like Votto and Stanton. So, you know, it makes sense that he placed a little bit lower on the ballot. Blackman, I can definitely see the case why people would think that he should have been an MVP candidate, but at the same time, you know, comparing his numbers to Stanton and Votto, it's still nowhere close. And yeah, while both Blackman and Arenado contributed greatly to the Rockies this year, you know, and helping them get to a wild card spot, I don't think that was, I don't think that that was a big factor considering Votto was playing for the Reds and Stanton was playing for the Marlins. So I feel like there is definitely a lot of bias in a lot of Rockies fans saying they should have been MVP, but, you know, looking at the numbers alone, they didn't really have a case that stands up against Votto and Stanton.
Yeah, I think with a lot of Rockies fans, they get annoyed, understandably, that so much focus is put on where their team plays. I mean, obviously, it's not the only, you know, batter-friendly ballpark in baseball, though it's considerably more batter-friendly than the second most batter-friendly ballpark. But then I also think there's, like, a tendency to kind of overcorrect for what they think are like, to, like, I guess, I think the argument is that, you know, a lot of the stats that, you know, weight based on park factors maybe overcorrect for Coors Field, but then in return, they, like, end up downplaying just how much it matters, or saying it, like, doesn't matter at all, and there's not enough, like, consideration of home road splits and that sort of thing. But that said, I shouldn't, you know, just be saying that it's Rockies fans who maybe thought that they deserve more consideration, because both Arenado and Blackman got first place votes in this MVP race. You know, Arenado got 2, Blackman got 3. That's part of what, you know, made things a bit closer, because, you know, the top 3 guys, like, you know, that took votes away from them. But it's, you know, so obviously people who actually have opinions that really matter on this, who, you know, get to affect the outcome of this, there obviously are some out there who think that those guys deserve more consideration. I did think it was pretty funny that the Dodger MLB.com guy, Ken Gernick, he had can't remember if it was Arenado first and Blackman second or the other way around, but I thought that was kind of interesting. Yeah, it was Arenado first, Blackman second. It's not the first time Gernick's had kind of an unusual vote. You'd only look at the Hall of Fame ballot where he left Greg Maddux off and voted only for Jack Morris. But that's a little different, because that's Hall of Fame. This is MVP, but nonetheless, thought it was interesting that he was one of the guys who valued their season so highly. Also, he put Kenley Jansen as 6th, which, wow. yeah, so Ken Gernick's ballot is another surprise that I would mention. I should also add that I think Ken Gernick is great at his job. I just think that his voting choices are sometimes, I sometimes just want to get, like, the exact thought process behind how he made those decisions, because, like, wow.
Yeah. I wonder if with some of these ballots, if it, the fact that they are publicly released kind of plays into it, so that these guys get a little bit more media time, the kind of the weirder their ballots are.
would not be surprised if that was the case. There's certainly been a lot of weird ballots over the years, and I know there's a lot of writers who are quick to defend it, but at the same time, I mean, who wouldn't be talking about Kenley Jansen placing, you know, getting a sixth place vote in the MVP race? So I can definitely understand why people would want to talk about it more and why people would probably put that on the ballot if it means that they're going to talk about their ballot more.
Were you guys surprised, kind of switching the topics a little bit, were you guys surprised by the margin of victory between Altuve and Judge at all?
Maybe a little. I guess I thought it might be a bit closer than it was, but at the same time, I expected Altuve to win. So I guess when it comes to margin, it's not, I don't know, I guess it's not the hugest surprise. It just turns out that a lot more voters thought Altuve was the winner than thought Judge was the winner than I might have expected. But outcome didn't surprise me. Margin surprised me a little, to sum that up.
Yeah, I agree. And just kind of looking at the balloting again, like, I'm not at all surprised that Altuve won. I'm surprised that he got most of the vote. Like, I thought it would have been at least a little bit closer, and maybe Judge would have gotten more than two first place votes. And yeah, I think it just wasn't what a lot of people expected in terms of how close it was. And I think a lot of people were right in their analysis that Judge wouldn't be given as many votes because he's a rookie. That being said, I don't think that just because a ball player is a rookie doesn't mean that they don't deserve MVP votes, but that's a whole nother conversation. But yeah, I think that it was a lot more of a margin than most would have expected. But, you know, thinking about the whole rookie thing, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and I think in cases like this, the actual point total is a little deceiving because it was so close, and it's not surprising that a lot of people leaned more toward Altuve, but also it's not like 27 people thought that Altuve was kind of the overwhelming first place candidate. It was just, you know, splitting hairs and then leaned one way rather than toward Judge.
Yeah, definitely. So moving on from the awards, retired ballplayer Aubrey Huff got some attention this week for some things he said on Twitter. It started with Huff claiming he'd read an article stating that humans evolved from rats and that the, quote, Bible, the truth is in the Bible. Of course, Huff was called out on this by numerous people, and somehow his tweets only got worse from there, with Huff going on to claim that while he used to believe in evolution, he no longer trusts, quote, mainstream scientists. But a highlight was Huff describing science as, quote, a popular opinion, not necessarily based on credible facts, telling a Twitter user to, quote, keep believing what you read in scientific journals and don't do any rational thought of your own. Yeah, so Dan Heron got in the replies on that one a little bit to note that that sounds a bit like religion. And then Huff also stated that the Earth is 6,000 years old, the climate change isn't real, and also evidently he believes in chemtrails. So what should we make of all of this, and just how dangerous are Huff's words?
it's a big one. I don't know how much influence Hoff himself has, but I think his views are dangerous in that they're indicative of, it seems to be an ever-growing minority in the country, and they seem to be kind of indicative of a lot of people who are now in charge of the country and in charge of deciding how much of a factor science will play in the country, and how dedicated the country is to fighting climate change. So I think in that sense, it's pretty dangerous. I would like to think that Hoff himself is just some crazy guy spouting off on Twitter. I didn't see too many people supporting him, which was good, but also I'm not really sure what his larger influence is outside of Twitter.
Yeah, on Twitter he has 11,000 followers, so, you know, not a huge following by any means, but nonetheless, the fact that he is out here saying these things, if he changes the mind of like one person, then that's kind of distressing. You know, that anyone would look at a ball player who is claiming that he knows better than scientists about, you know, the truth behind where life came from. And that to me is disconcerting, and what's also unsettling is the fact that I know he's probably not the only MLB player or retired MLB player who has these beliefs. I think most people are probably aware enough, if they do think this way, to not make it public, you know, at least until they're retired. I don't think Huff was, you know, doing this so much until after he was done playing, at least, but still, it's not something you want to see someone in his position saying. You worry that others may follow suit. It's all disturbing. You know, people are entitled to their religious beliefs. They really are, but only to the extent that they're not spreading harmful lies. And, you know, you can believe, I think, in both religion and science. I really don't think that the two are mutually exclusive at all. And I just don't think that, I think Huff is taking everything way too literally. Although I guess maybe he's also not taking things literally enough, because like Deadspin did a thing where they actually found the article he was talking about, and it's not what it said at all. The article did not say that humans evolved from rats, because no one believes that. It said something about them, like the ancestor of all mammals being a small rat-like creature that no longer exists. But, you know, Huff obviously doesn't have great reading comprehension and was more interested in spouting off uninformed opinions, because apparently that's what he likes to do. This is all going a little bit off the rails on my end, but basically I think that there is definitely danger to his words and danger to his ideas, but it probably doesn't have too much of an impact, like Mary said, fortunately, but it having any impact at all is also really disconcerting.
I feel like because he played in San Francisco, a lot of people are going to push back against him, which is, you know, saying something to San Francisco's liberal reputation. But at the same time, you know, it's good that Giants fans are like telling Huff off, and not just fans, but even one of the Giants beat writers. Kind of making a dig at him. Andrew Baggerly was like one of the, you know, he made fun of one of Huff's hashtags, and then said it was like easier than hashtag playing yourself out of, you know, playing by falling over a rail. So it seems like it's not just fans who were kind of disappointed that he was talking about this. I know Dan Heron obviously got in on it and were trying to tell him that he was wrong, and so did Keith Law. It was just very, very good to see that there were people pushing back against him, but also bad to see that he was still trying to tweet through it days later. I made a joke on Twitter saying that his Twitter meltdown has lasted than Barstool Van Talk, because it's sadly accurate, because it's still going on in some ways. And also saying, like, I didn't do my homework while I was at the University of Miami. I just faxed all my homework to my mom. He is saying some very, very odd things in the sense that it doesn't seem healthy. And I'm also kind of wondering if, like, there's any other reason behind him trying to tweet through it, because I know he spent the last portion of his career on the disabled list seeking help for mental illness, so who knows? You know, that obviously doesn't excuse the garbage he's spewing out on Twitter, but I wonder if it's part of a larger issue with Huff.
No, that's a good point. I think that's something that people don't necessarily take into consideration with, you know, people who are saying kind of unconscionable things. And like you said, obviously doesn't excuse the things that they're saying, but it could be part of an explanation and could, you know, be something to consider about why people feel like they have these sort of ideas. But just to change gears a little bit, I have to say I am just so grateful that Dan Heron exists. Just seeing the way that he got in on Huff and was like, yeah, dude, this is not okay. Like, what you're saying is ridiculous and hypocritical. And it's not the first time Heron has proven to be awesome on Twitter, but he routinely seems to prove that. There was something that came out of this that was really nice, I thought, and that was so one of my fellow contributors over at Dodgers Digest made like an offhand comment about how, you know, he wonders like how much Clayton Kershaw must have hated Dan Heron, because Kershaw, you know, he's a pretty religious guy, pretty into, you know, the whole Christianity deal. And so, you know, in theory, a guy who's like a proclaimed atheist like Heron might not get along with a guy like Kershaw. But Heron found this tweet and was like, no, that's not really true. We had a lot of really good, respectful discussions about our own particular points of view, and he's really understanding, meaning Kershaw, and he's really, you know, willing to listen and open to learning, and, you know, he understands that faith is like a personal thing and it's not something to be like pushed too much on other people. And that's paraphrasing. That's not exactly what Heron said. But nonetheless, it was kind of nice to see, oh, so Kershaw, good dude. Like, I don't know. Anytime I get confirmation of that, I'm like, all right, that's reassuring. So at least we got that out of all this mess.
That's definitely good. It's always kind of nice to see that not only one of your favorite players, but somebody who's just so highly regarded across Major League Baseball is such a good person and is tolerant and kind of understands things that maybe not a lot of other players or fans understand. And hopefully he can kind of make that position more widespread across baseball.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like if anything, it's a teachable moment, but the way that Huff has gone about it is clearly not going to listen to anyone. But Heron, you know, Heron and Kershaw are good dudes, and I'm very glad that, you know, it came out that they both had respectful conversations about religion and didn't immediately shoot the other down, but were willing to understand each other's point. I think that is a big sign of how, you know, there could be respectful discussions about this in the clubhouses. And if there's respectful discussions about this, who knows what other topics would come about. So, moving on, we're still waiting for the hot stove to get truly hot, and there weren't a ton of big moves this past week. Jerry DePoto, though, was at it again, acquiring Ryan Healy from the A's in exchange for Emilio Pagan and a minor leaguer. He also traded pitcher Thiago Vieira to the White Sox for international bonus money. In other news, all nine of the players who received one-year qualifying offers from their teams rejected them and are now free agents. This list includes Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas, Lorenzo Cain, Jake Arrieta, Wade Davis, Lance Lynn, Alex Cobb, Greg Holland, and Carlos Santana. There was also the news that Carlos Beltran is officially retiring, something he announced in a Players Tribune post that was extremely good. So if you have the chance to read that, please do. And we have a relevant Twitter question here from Matt, who is at TGMWB. Each of you should make a bold prediction of a trade that nobody has talked about or expects that you think could happen this offseason.
Oh boy.
I think that Pujols will get traded somehow.
You're really holding out for that.
I really am. My galaxy brain prediction is, you know, I don't know if I mentioned it on here before, but it's Pujols gets traded with one of the better Angels players, namely Mike Trout, if not Trout, someone else, should be traded in exchange for a couple of top prospects and some cash in order to offset Pujols' salary, sort of like the Craig Kimbrell, Melvin Upton trade of years past that would partly a salary dump. So yeah, I strongly believe that the Angels should do that, and I don't think anyone expects that it could happen this offseason. Or ever.
That's a good one. I think that is something that actually makes some amount of logical sense, but nonetheless would be completely shocking, and nobody really would guess that would happen. My bold prediction that I don't actually think is going to happen, but that would definitely be hugely surprising if it did, is the Tigers trading Miguel Cabrera. I think they are leaning full on into this rebuild, and so wouldn't be surprised to see them try to, you know, dump some of their, either some of their salary or to try and take on, you know, some, to build up the farm system a little bit more. And Cabrera has a big contract that lasts until like 2023. So he makes sense as a piece to move, although I don't know exactly if the market really is there for him at this point. But that's why it's a bold prediction, because it doesn't seem like something that has a chance of happening.
Yeah, Yeah, I was gonna talk about Miguel Cabrera too. I think that's probably one of the more realistic, unexpected things that could happen. I think that maybe the Mets will do something. They'll trade one of their arms. I don't know which one or where, but it just seems like a Mets thing to do, particularly if the new management coaching staff is not on board with one of them. I think that we could see something there.
I think if the Mets were to trade Noah Syndergaard, they're going to have to trade Mr. Met with him, just to keep that whole disdain for Mr. Met going. That being said, I would not be surprised if they eventually trade Jacob deGrom. I think that there's a lot of value there. I think that the Mets don't realize that even though they were in the World Series in 2015, that, you know, they're not doing great and it might be time to kind of dismantle and rebuild, but who knows how they'll do next season. But I can definitely see the Mets trading one of their young arms. So, moving on to the rest of our Twitter questions. This one is from Kazuto, at Kazuto Yamazaki. He said, discuss this guy for 10 minutes or as long as you want, and he linked to a baseball reference profile of Turkey Gross, which is very fitting for the upcoming holiday.
It is. Good call on that, Kaz.
Yeah.
So this guy played 9 games in April of 1925 for Boston. Before that and after that, he kind of made his way around the Texas League, primarily playing for Dallas. He did not have a lot of success in Major League Baseball. His batting average over these 9 games. So he got 3 hits in 32 at-bats for a 0.94 batting average. He had an OPS of 3.28. Not great. You can kind of see why he only survived 9 games, even with the 1925 Red Sox, who finished 8th and lost 105 games. So even on that abysmal team, there was really no space for this turkey guy.
I'm just trying to figure out how he got that nickname.
Yeah. I was looking earlier and I have no idea. I don't know. Like, turkeys are not a huge thing in Texas. So I don't know where he got it because he spent the vast majority of his life in Texas. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it doesn't, of all the animals to be compared to, that doesn't really seem like a positive one, I guess, unless you're Benjamin Franklin, because he had a thing about turkeys for some reason. But yeah, it's an interesting nickname for sure. I'm not sure it's a flattering one, especially paired with that last name. I don't know if it's pronounced gross, but that's how it's spelled. I mean, I think turkey's kind of gross. Not that I have eaten it in about a decade, because it's about as long as I've been a vegetarian, but it wasn't my favorite meat back when I did eat it. So it sounds less like the name of a ball player than it does my reaction to someone offering me turkey. Like, oh, turkey, gross.
Although I have to say, like, his actual name is Ewell, and that's not great either.
That is a weird name, you're right.
I'm wondering if it had anything to do with, you know, popular slang at the time, because I remember, like, in the 40s or 50s, if you call someone a turkey, that means they're kind of a dud, or like they're not really a smart person.
Yeah, like you're a jive turkey. Like that
yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
I guess that's a little later, but.
But like, you know, that slang kind of stuck around for a while from like the 40s to the 70s. And, you know, some people still use it these days, but I'm wondering how much slang of the day played into that. But also looking at his Saber Bio Project page, he is pretty interesting dude. He was out of baseball in 1919. He apparently started work early in noted in the 1910 census at the age of 14, was a bootblack working in a barber shop, began his professional baseball career in 1915 with the Paris, Texas club in the Western Association. And then in 1917 and 1918, which was the years that the U.S. was in World War I, and in 1919 he was out of baseball, serving 21 months in the Army. And then in 1920, he was found working as a superintendent in a cotton gin. He eventually got back into baseball following that, and then found his way into the major leagues for a couple of games. According to this Saber bio, he was released on May 1st of, I believe, the year he was playing. Don't have that offhand. It was 1925, I believe. Yeah. And he wasn't sent out on option. He was released. It was funny because he being manager Lee Fall, let Gross go before either Buddy Connolly or Dud Lee was quite ready to take over at shortstop. And I'm just laughing that the successor of Turkey was potentially a guy named Dud.
They don't nickname them like they used to.
No.
So in 1930, the census recorded him living with his wife, Novella, working as the operator of a skating rink. His last work in professional baseball came in 1931 when he managed the Kilgore Gushers for a full season of East Texas League play. Gross died of pyelonephritis.
Wikipedia says that's a kidney infection. Okay. Yeah. I had no idea either.
Yeah.
In January of 1936, and he was working as a druggist in Mesquite. So, very interesting guy, to say the least.
Yeah,
still no trace of where his nickname came from, though.
No, that's the real thing. But I feel like he's kind of a good example of so many players that existed in these early years, where they kind of had, you know, some success in the minors, came out of nowhere, didn't last long, kind of went back into obscurity and then died at a young age. Like, that's pretty much the formula for a lot of these early years of baseball.
That's true, and also kind of depressing, but it's nice that things like the Saber Bio Project exist to help tell their stories and to track down their histories, because otherwise maybe no one would remember them. But it's cool that we have this record of their time playing. And I have to just note that talking about guys who went by the name Turkey, apparently Turkey Gross was not the only one. There was a guy who played one game for the Phillies in 1944, and his name was Turkey Tyson. And that's kind of fun because, you know, Tyson makes, like, meat products, and they sell you can get turkey from them. I assume this predates that. I don't know for sure, but that I don't know. But if they existed at the same time, it seems like there would have been a good, marketing opportunity there had he been any good. But unfortunately for him, he only got the one at bat, so he never really got the chance to prove himself beyond that.
Definitely. So next question.
I just want to say, I think we actually managed to talk about Turkey Gross for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I was going to say, we did pretty well.
Yeah, I think we did. So,
all right.
You're welcome, Kaz. So the next question is from Jaime, at Jaimito Gomez. I remember Alex Cora coming up as a rookie, and now he's managing the Red Sox. Who's the first player that made you feel old?
I have two answers for this. The first one is Bryce Harper, because he was the first player who is younger than me, and I assume that's the same for you, Mary. And the other one is Jock Peterson, because he was the first Dodger who was younger than me. So those two both made me feel old.
Yeah, definitely Bryce Harper. And he also made me feel inadequate with how good he was at such a young age. Like, how dare you, Bryce? And then my other one is Ortiz, because I watched his entire career with the Red Sox, and then he was retiring, and when he retired, it was just like, oh my goodness, I watched this guy for this many years, and now he's gone. Like, how old am I? Answer, not that old, but also really old in terms of athlete years.
So for me, it was also two players. One actually being Mickey Moniak when he was drafted, because last year, 2016, when he was drafted, I was actually in contact with him trying to talk to him for my master's capstone thesis, and never really did get that interview from him. But I was just thinking, like, these guys are barely 18 being drafted. What the hell? So him and, like, Blake Rutherford made me realize, like, wow, I'm so far removed from being that age. This is surreal. The other one being Matt Cain when he retired this year, because I remember his career very vividly. I didn't see the entirety of his career because I didn't really start watching baseball till 2007. But, you know, I remember his peak years with the Giants very well. And I still remember when he would always get a no decision because the Giants either couldn't get the offense going or the bullpen sucked, which is still the case. Knowing that he retired this past year made me realize, oh wow, that's a long time and I feel old.
I guess we also need to shout out Cody Bellinger and the Seinfeld debacle, because I think that made everyone feel old. Like, even the people who are younger than him and know who Jerry Seinfeld is, like, I think we all were just like, ah, man, you're so young. You don't even know who Jerry Seinfeld is or what Seinfeld as a TV show was. I think that sort of made everyone feel older than they actually are.
That made me feel so good about myself, though, because generally I'm the one who's like, who is this, you know, incredibly popular pop culture person that I've never heard of. And so for me to know who Jerry Seinfeld was, that was a great moment personally.
Yeah, I agree with Sarah that, you know, Bellinger made a lot of people feel old. Not everyone is you, Mary.
Thank God for that, though, really. You betcha.
So the next question is from Prescott, who is at Lover of Puig. Which out-of-nowhere superstar will the Dodgers trade no one for?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that Andrew Friedman really likes to trade with the Rays. So I don't have a specific name in mind, but I feel like it's going to be someone who comes from the Rays.
It's going to be Jamie Archer, and then he's going to get really good again. Chris Archer. Jamie Archer. I don't know who that is.
Jamie Archer.
Who is Jamie Archer?
I was like, well, that's someone who would certainly be out of nowhere because I don't think he exists. I mean, I'm sure there's a Jamie Archer out there somewhere. I just don't know if they're in baseball.
If they are, they're with the Rays.
Yes. I'm on board with this plan. I like this idea.
Yeah, I think that would probably work out great in the Dodgers' favor, and it would make the most sense. The next question is, again, from Jaime, at Jaimito Gomez. What would each of your walk-up songs be as a batter and as a closer?
So, I said on Twitter yesterday that as a closer, it would be Hearts Barracuda. So that's my answer. I'm sticking with it.
So you're using that for both a walk-up song as a batter and you're okay.
Like, I only know about 10 songs, so
Mary, I have a confession that after Jaime asked that question, he DM'd me and he was like, I can't wait to see what Mary's answer is to this question. He's like, it's probably going to be like a video game song or something.
I've never played a video game.
I think he just meant like in terms of it just being some weird thing that no one's ever heard of.
It's going to be a Baroque song.
That's the reputation that you have going for yourself, Mary. And I don't think it's a bad thing.
No, it's fine. It's fine. It's not inaccurate.
Okay, so I have long thought that my walk-up song would be The Promised Land by Bruce Springsteen, just because it's my favorite song, so why would I not want to hear my favorite song when I'm trying to get pumped up? I'm debating. For some reason, I feel like I would want something different as a bullpen song coming out of the bullpen. And I think I would probably also want to go with Springsteen for that, too, just because that's who I am as a person. And I feel like, I don't know, maybe Born to Run, you know, maybe one of his more epic sounding songs. I think that's what I would go with.
Can I change my answer or alter it?
Yes.
I would say for a walk-up song, it would be the Crazy Frog song, because it would be impossible for a pitcher to pitch well when that's stuck in their head. So that's my answer for a walk-up song.
All right, that's more like it, Mary.
There we go.
I would probably go with a Springsteen song as well for my walk-up song, because that is also who I am. For those of you who do not know, Sarah and I are very similar in our love for Bruce Springsteen.
Best of baseball?
Yeah, Jen and I are the stereotypical middle-aged white dude baseball writers. I just want to say, it's something that developed separate from our love for baseball. Like, the two are, like, completely unrelated. But nonetheless, we still very much fit that stereotype.
Yeah, I developed a love for Springsteen well before I developed a love for baseball. So it just somehow fit together. But I would probably go with one of Springsteen's somewhat newer songs from the Rising album. I would go with Further On Up the Road for my walk-up song, and for coming out of the bullpen as a closer. For some reason, I'm just imagining, like, Jungle Land.
Ooh, that is a good choice.
So I would go with Further On Up the Road as my walk-up song as a batter, and coming in from the bullpen, Jungle Land.
Those are good calls. Another one that just came into my head that I think would work really well as a bullpen song is Adam Raised a Cane.
Yes, that would be a good choice.
That would be so good.
So now we're on to our final question from Prescott again at Lover of Puig. Will the Giancarlo sweepstakes be hindered by Bryce Harper's looming free agency?
No, they'll be hindered by Derek Jeter. I don't think so. I think that they're generally going to be pretty separate events. And I don't think that anybody's going to kind of thumb their nose at getting Stanton because there's this minute possibility that they could get Harper.
I also think that it would be different for teams because with Stanton, they're obviously going to give up players and or cash for him because it's going to be a trade no matter what. With Bryce Harper, you know, it's just going to be a lot of teams throwing cash at him. So I think it's also going to be a factor that, you know, different teams, different priorities, different leverage that they have in the market.
That said, do we think that there's any chance that the Nats trade Harper mid-season?
Probably. I mean, it's the Nats.
I think it depends on how well the Nats are doing next season. I don't think they're going to face a lot of competition, but in the event that they're anywhere not at the top of the NL East standings, they'll probably trade Harper for as many top prospects as they can get.
No, yeah, they're going to waiver wire him on like the final day of the season or something just to really kind of twist in the knife to all of their fans.
Yeah, I think that the Nats are probably going to pretty much run away with their division, so the odds of a Harper trade probably aren't great. I don't think anybody is banking on that. That said, I think Jen, you said it right, which is that in the case of Harper, you're basically just saving money to throw at him. Whereas with Giancarlo, it's money and it's prospects. And, you know, while some teams obviously have both at their disposal, not all teams do. And I think that thus the markets for the two of them are going to be fairly different. So I don't think I would say that Harper's looming free agency is going to affect what happens with Giancarlo all that much.
So moving on to our articles from the site this past week, Sarah, take it away.
Thank you. On Monday, we have Inducting Defense by Dave Jordan. Omer Vizquel, arguably a top 20 all-time defensive shortstop, is going to be on next year's Hall of Fame ballot. But should he make it? For perspective, the author of this article, Dave, talked to Hall of Fame pitcher Jim Palmer, who played with another all-time great shortstop, Mark Bellinger. The conclusion that Dave seems to come to is that, like with Bellinger, Vizquel's great defense isn't enough to overcome his subpar offense. However, Dave raises some intriguing questions about how much defense should be considered in Cooperstown voting and will get you thinking about the subject. Then on Tuesday, we have The Future of Versatility, a Tool for Platoon Advantage by Michael Hattery. Here, Michael speculates on what the next big trend in baseball may be, positional flexibility, exemplified by players like catcher slash second baseman Austin Barnes and Ben Zobrist, who played 5 different positions for the Cubs last season. The author argues that having players who can fill in at different spots based on platoon advantages could be something teams start focusing on and that those who prioritize this will reap the benefits. Then on Wednesday, we have Awareness and Opportunity by Sungmin Kim. The great Sungmin talked to some Getty Images photographers who worked at the World Series, getting the scoop on how they prepare for their shots, what they look for, the specific technology used, etc. If you've ever looked at a well-timed baseball photo and wondered just how the photographer pulled it off, Sungmin's piece may offer some insight.
All right, and then on Thursday, we have The Ohtani Algorithm by Daniel R. Epstein. One of the biggest off-season stories is trying to deduce which team Japanese two-way sensation Shohei Ohtani will sign with. In this piece, Daniel takes a stab at answering the question in a more logical manner through addressing several factors like team interest, playing time, money, team success, and cultural comfort. If you want to know how these factors shake out, according to Daniel, you'll have to read the piece. And then rounding out the week on Friday, we have Touching Them All Minus One, Romancing the Triple by Frank Jackson. Frank begins by remarking about the Blue Jays' lack of triples this season. They hit only 5, which was worst in the majors. And this leads him to question why teams now hit more home runs than triples, when that was not the case with early teams, and the shift didn't occur until 1925 or 1930. Finally, the piece asks if the triple really is the most exciting play. Should we try to salvage it? And will it ever become extinct?
So for next week's articles, on Monday, we have Bruce Marcuzin on Oakland's 1973-1974 managerial search. On Tuesday, Max Gruber has a written version of his 2016 Sabre seminar presentation. On Wednesday, Shane Tortolotti looks back at the 2017 postseason, and there will be no articles on Thursday and Friday due to Thanksgiving. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah @SarahWexler32, and you can find Mary @MaryMCraig. You can find the podcast on Twitter @THTAudio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com, you can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.